Chapter 18. At 7 o'clock the next morning, the telephone woke me up. It was Fay calling from wherever they were staying. "We'll buy your equity in the house," she said. "Here's what we can give you. $1,000 cash, and the rest in the form of monthly payments of $38. We sat up half the night discussing it. I said, "The only thing is that I want to stay here." "You can't," she said. "Did it occur to you that everything in that house belongs either to the girls or to me? And if we want to, we can keep you from using the refrigerator or the sink. You can't even use the towels in the bathroom. You can't even eat off the dishes in the rack on the drain board. My good God, you can't even sit down in a chair. That bed you're sleeping in doesn't come with the house. That's part of the personal property. And he only left you his share of the house. The sheets on the bed. The ashtrays." She went on and on, working herself up. "And how are you going to eat? I'll bet you think you're going to walk into the kitchen and open up a few cans and packages of food. Do you think that food is yours? It isn't. And if you eat one bite of it, I'll sue you. I'll take you to court and sue you." I hadn't realized it. What she said was true. "There's a lot in what you say," I said. "I'll have to get my own furniture." She said, "I think I'll have the movers up from Fairfax and move everything out of that house." "Okay," I said, taken aback and having difficulty thinking. "You idiot," Fay said. "All you've got in this world is that empty box of a house. Half that empty box of a house. And we can keep up our share of the payments with what we're getting in from the factory." She hung up then. I dressed and combed my hair, and then I went into the kitchen and stood wondering if I should fix myself breakfast or not. Suppose while I was eating it, Fay appeared with the sheriff or someone. Wouldn't I, in a sense, be stealing the food? Unable to decide, I at last gave up the idea of eating breakfast. Instead, I went outdoors and down to the chicken pen to throw grain to the banties. How empty the duck pen was without the ducks. The trough remained, the porcelain sink that Charlie had put down for them, and the drainage system that he had been working on. There was even a duck egg left over, half buried in the weeds that the ducks had made into a nest. And in the garbage can, half a sack of egg grow, almost 50 pounds of it. I wandered on to the stable that Charlie had built for the horse. There was the saddle hanging up on the wall, and all the other equipment that had gone with the horse. Over $300 worth of stuff. Returning to the house, I seated myself on the floor near the fireplace and thought. I spent most of the morning deep in thought, and at last I came to the conclusion that what I had to do was find a way of bringing in enough money to make my monthly payments on the house, including what I had to pay on the taxes and insurance. Also, I needed to have enough money to buy food, because it was now clearly apparent that Fay and Nat would not give me any of theirs. I had had the half-formed notion that we could go back to something like the old system, with me doing babysitting for them, although not the dirty work, the scrubbing part, and them supplying me with what would be an equitable amount of supplies, such as food and the like. However, that was off. After figuring, I came to the conclusion that I would have to earn almost $500 a month in order to keep up my end of the house, and this did not include either unusual medical bills or house repairs. Anyhow, I could make the payments, eat, buy some clothes, etc., and acquire some second-hand furniture. I therefore got out on the road and hitchhiked to Point Reyes Station. There, I started looking for a job. The first place I tried was the garage on the corner. I told them that I wasn't a mechanic, but that I had a scientific disposition and was good at analyzing and diagnosis. They told me they didn't have any openings, so I went on across the street to the market. There was nothing there either, even a job such as opening crates and putting out the merchandise on the shelves. I next tried at the big hardware store. They said that the only person they could use was one who could drive. After that, I tried at the post office for the job of postal clerk, but there they told me that a federal civil service exam was required. I tried the other garages and gas stations, the pharmacy, the coffee shop. At least there should have been a job of dishwasher open. And the dress shop, even the little free library. No work was available at any place. I tried the feed store, the big building supply yard, and finally the bank. The man at the bank was very helpful. He recognized me as Faye's brother, and we sat down at his desk and talked for a long time. I explained my situation, why I wanted work, and how much I had to have. The man told me that it was next to impossible to find work at any of the retail businesses in the area, because they all did such a limited operation. My best bet, he said, was either the dairy ranches out on the point, or down at Alema at the mill, or over at the gravel works on the Petaluma Road, or the RCA station out on the Lighthouse Road. If I could drive, he said, I could probably get a job driving the school bus, but that was obviously out. In summer I could pick produce, but this was only April. Of the various alternatives, it seemed to me that a job on one of the dairy farms would be the best, because of my love of animals. Thanking the man, I hitchhiked back on to the Inverness side of the bay, and then, by means of several rides, managed to get out to some of the ranches. It took all day. The only job that was open was that of milker, and this reminded me of what Charlie had said originally, that milking would be my best bet up here in the country. Milking, however, although it sounded like interesting work, paid only $1.30 an hour, and this would not be enough for me to meet my expenses. In addition, I would have to actually live on the various ranches, and this would defeat the whole purpose of the job. So milking was out. Toward evening, feeling discouraged and tired, I started hitchhiking back to town. Fortunately, the people at one of the ranches were kind enough to give me a big lunch. Otherwise, I would have had nothing to eat all day. As it was, I got back to the house at 9:30 in the evening, thoroughly depressed and tired, with no prospect of work. I turned on the light in the living room, and because the house was so cold, I lit a fire in the fireplace, even though I was conscious that the wood belonged to Faye and the children, not to me. Even the discarded newspapers which we always used to start fires did not belong to me, nor the milk cartons that we saved out of the garbage. Only the stuff in the study that I had carried with me from the Hombros. Thinking about it, I wondered if possibly anybody in the group might be able to help me find a job that paid $500 a month. I therefore took a chance and telephoned Mrs. Hombro. Although she was sympathetic, she seemed to feel that there was no chance that I'd find a job paying anything like that much. She pointed out that in a farm area, wages were generally lower than in the city. And even for San Francisco, $500 a month was a pretty high salary. At 10, while I was seated before the fire, the phone rang. I answered it. Again, it was Faye, calling from wherever they were staying. "I came by during the day," she said. "Where were you?" "Out," I said. Faye said, "Are you going to get psychiatric help?" "I haven't thought about it," I said. "Maybe if you go see Dr. Andrews, you'll get more insight into your situation. Why don't you sell your part of the house? I talked to him today, and he says that you identify with Charlie and are getting revenge on us for his death. You hold us responsible for him killing himself. Is that why you won't sell? Good God, think of the children. They've lived in that house ever since it was built. We actually built it for them, not for ourselves. And that's virtually all the son of a bitch left me, except for that nothing factory that hardly makes enough to pay its own way. I have to have that house. Half of it is mine, and you can bet your bottom dollar I'll never let my half go. Anyhow, you couldn't buy it from me, could you? My God, you can't even pay the $1.50 water bill." I said nothing. Faye went on. "I think we'll come over and discuss it with you. We'll see you in about 15 minutes. Before I could tell her that I was totally exhausted and about ready for bed, the phone had clicked. She had hung up. It never occurred to her to inquire whether I wanted to discuss it with her or not. That's the way she's always been. Nothing will ever change her. Even more depressed than before, I sat waiting for them to come. In a sense, she was right. The children belonged in the house. And since she refused to live with me, the children would not be living here unless I moved out. She, of course, considered it her house, and to a degree it was. But certainly it was not her house in the sense that she meant it, that it was hers and no one else's. The fact of the matter was that the house belonged to Charlie, and that he had divided it between her and me, with the obvious idea that both of us would live here. Charlie assumed that since Faye and I were sister and brother, we would be able to live together. What he thought Nat Antiel would do, I have no idea. Possibly he did not realize that Antiel's wife had left him and that their marriage was over. He may have assumed that the relationship between Faye and Nat was only a passing affair. In that, he was not alone. None of us had thought of it persisting. Had Charlie come back and not killed himself, nor Faye, then no doubt her assignations with Antiel would have come to an end. He had only to return to the house to put an end to the situation, at least to keep them from physically coming together. Of course, the bond between them might continue, and that was why he did what he did. He had wanted to punish her for what she had done. I think he was right. She deserved whatever she got. However, at the end, she had outsmarted him and gotten him to kill himself instead. Even though he had drawn up a will that excluded her from the body of his estate, she still had her life, her half of the house, her children, and the household goods, even the car. And all that remained of Charlie was the eternal presence that pervaded the house, the presence that I felt so keenly all the time I was there. In fact, even now, as I sat trying to see a way out of this dilemma, I sensed Charlie around the house, in each part of it in proportion to the extent that he had inhabited that part while physically alive, especially in the study where he had worked at night. I felt it there the most, not so much in the children's rooms or even their bedroom, and not at all in Faye's workroom, where she did her clay modeling, her creative stuff. What he hadn't realized was that if he had killed her, nobody would ever have had a happy moment again. Think what the effect would have been on the children. Their lives would have been blighted. He himself would have nothing left ahead of him but death from his heart condition, unless he had planned to kill himself too. Nat Antiel had already given up his wife, seen his brief marriage to her end, and with Faye dead, what would there be in store for him? Who would have gained? The nihilism of what Charlie did is shown in his killing of the animals. That part affected me the most. I had the greatest difficulty understanding it. Surely he hadn't hated the animals as he hated Faye? He couldn't possibly have thought that the animals had betrayed him. Although, of course, the dog had learned to greet Antiel rather than to bark at him. To follow the logic of that, however, he would have had to kill his own daughters since they both like Antiel, and he would possibly even have had to kill me, since the girls like me very much. Maybe he planned to. Anyhow, the sheep cared for nobody on earth, and the ducks, to the extent possible with their limited minds, kept a loyalty to him. After all, it had been he who built their pens. After thinking it over steadily, I came to the conclusion that he had not known he was killing the animals, that he had only been conscious that when he got back to the house, after being in the hospital, there would be some great change, which he himself would bring about, and that this change would affect all the living creatures there. He shot the animals to show that what he did mattered. He could do something that couldn't be undone. And yet even deciding this, I felt then, and still feel now, that the actual reasons for his actions are beyond my scope. I don't understand his kind of illogical semi-barbaric mind. It was not a question of scientific reason, it was brute instinct. Perhaps he identified the animals with himself. Possibly he was already beginning on the path of killing himself, that he knew in some part of his mind that he would never kill Faye, that it would be he who would end up getting shot, not she. Or possibly he hadn't even wanted to kill her, that he had only gone through the motions. Possibly he had meant to kill himself all the time from the moment he bought the gun. In that case, she was not to blame, at least not as much. But a confusion like this always results when the unscientific individual is involved. Science is baffled by the unreason of the hoi polloi. The moods of the mass can't be fathomed. That's a fact. While I was studying this entire situation deeply and waiting for Faye and Nat, I heard their car drive up. So I got to my feet and went to the front door to turn on the driveway lights. Only one person came from the car. It was Nat Antheil. My sister hadn't come along. "Where's Faye?" I said. Nat said, "Somebody had to stay with the girls." He entered the house and shut the door after him. His explanation, although reasonable, didn't convince me. I had the intuition that she couldn't bring herself to set foot inside the house as long as I was still there. And that made me feel just that much worse.
"Sometimes it's easier for two men to discuss a business matter," Nat said, "without a woman."
"True," I said. We sat down facing each other in the living room. Looking across, past the fireplace at him, I got to wondering how old he was. Was he older or younger than I? About the same age, I decided. And look how little he had done with his life. A marriage that hadn't lasted a bit. Involvement with a married woman that had ended in the death of an innocent man. And, from what I had heard, a fairly insecure economic position. The only thing he had over me was that, to be very honest, he was much better looking than I. He had that sweet, open face, roundish, and jet-black hair which he kept cut short. He was tall, too, without appearing scrawny or bony. In fact, he looked to me like a tennis player, with very long arms and legs, but at the same time keeping himself in good physical condition. Also, I had respect for his intelligence. "Well," I said, "this is a difficult situation."
"No doubt of that," Nat said.
We sat for a time in silence. Nat lit a cigarette.
"You don't want to be a dog in the manger," he said. "It's indisputable that you can't raise the capital to buy Faye out. And even if you did, you couldn't afford to live here. The cost of keeping this place going is enormous. It's a completely impractical house. Personally, I'm not anxious to see Faye keep it. It's too costly to heat. I'd rather see her sell it and move into a smaller place, possibly an older house."
"But she has her heart set on living here," I said.
"Yes," he said. "She likes it. But if she had to, she could give it up. I think in the long run she'll want to give it up, after she's had to keep it running without Charlie. In some respects, it's more a liability than an asset."
Getting to his feet, he wandered around the living room.
"It's nice. It's really a marvelous house to live in. But it'd take a really well-off person to maintain it. It's a constant drain. A person could wind up a slave to it, trying to keep it going. I don't think I'd ever want to do that. I hope to hell I don't get in that position."
He did not seem to be especially talking to me. I sensed that he was actually thinking out loud. I said, "Are you and Faye going to get married?" He nodded.
"As soon as I get my divorce from Gwen. We'll probably get a Mexican divorce and remarriage. There's no waiting period."
I said, "Since Charlie didn't leave her very much, won't you have to go to work full-time to support her and the children?"
"There's the trust fund to support the kids," he said, "and she'll be getting enough from the factory and her property in Florida to maintain this place."
"I really don't want to give my share up," I said. "I want to live here."
"Why?" he said, turning to face me. "My God, it's got 3 bathrooms and 4 bedrooms. You'd be living alone, one person in this huge house. This place was built for 5 or 6 people to live in. All you need is a rented room."
I said nothing.
"You'll go out of your mind here," Nat said, "all alone. When Charlie first went to the hospital, Faye almost went crazy alone, and she had the girls to keep her company."
"And you," I said. To that he had no comment. "I feel I have to stay here," I said.
"Why?"
"Because," I said, "it's my duty."
"To what?"
"My duty to him," I said, letting it slip out before I realized what I had done. Without difficulty, he grasped whom I meant.
"You mean because he left half the house to you, you feel you must live here?"
"Not exactly," I said. I didn't want to tell him that I knew that Charlie was still in the house. Nat said,
"Since you can't do it, it doesn't matter whether it's your duty or not. As I see it, your choice isn't whether to give up your share. It's whether you'll sell it and get something for it, or simply lose it and get nothing. With $1,000 cash and $38 every month, you could establish yourself very nicely in town. Rent a nice apartment, buy clothes, eat out in good restaurants. Go out in the evenings and have a big time, right? And meanwhile, you'd be using the money he left for psychiatric care. And if you had psychiatric care, you'd be a lot better off. Let's face it.
He had picked up that phrase, "let's face it," for my sister. It's interesting how one person's vocabulary affects another person. Everyone who ever had anything to do with her winds up saying that. And also, "in my entire life," and "my good God." Not to mention the really foul language. "I just don't want to leave this house," I repeated. And then suddenly, I remembered something that I had forgotten. And it was something that Nat did not know. Or if he did, he did not accept. The world was coming to an end in a month. So it didn't matter what happened after that. I only had to stay here a month, not forever. Then there would be no house. I told Nat that I couldn't decide, that I still had to think it over. He went back home, and I sat by myself in the living room for most of the night, considering. At last, about 4 in the morning, I came to a decision. I got into the bed in the study and slept, sleep being something I badly needed. Then, the next morning, I got up at 8 o'clock, took a bath and shaved, dressed, ate some Post's 40% bran flakes and toast and jam, which wasn't very much to take, and then set out along the road toward the Inverness Y. There was one job possibility that I had overlooked that I wanted to try. At the Y was a vet's, not one that worked merely with sick dogs and cats as the ones in town did, but with sheep and cattle and horses, as well as smaller livestock. Since at one time I worked for a vet's, it seemed to me that I might have a chance here. However, after I had talked to the vet, I discovered that it was a family-run affair, the doctor and his wife and 10-year-old son and father. The 10-year-old boy did the feeding and sweeping that I had in mind. So I started back toward Drake's Landing. At least I had explored every possibility. Approximately at 12:30 in the afternoon, I got back to the house. I right away telephoned Nat Antiel's number. It was Faye who answered. Evidently, Nat was either at work or doing his homework. "I've come to a decision," I told my sister. "My goodness," she said. I said, "I'll sell you my half of the house for the $1,000 down and the rest in payments, if you'll let me live in the house for the next month. And I have to be able to use the furniture and food and everything, so I can really live there." "It's a deal," Faye said. "You horse's ass. You better not eat any of those steaks in the freezer. None of the T-bone or sirloin or New York cut. There's $40 worth of steaks in there." "Okay," I agreed. "The steaks don't count. But I can eat any other food I find. And I want the money right away. Within the next day or two, no longer. And I don't have to pay any of the utility bills for the month."
"There's things we need," Faye said. "All the children's things. Their clothes. Good God, my clothes, a million things. I don't want to move all those things out and then have to move them back in again. Why do you have to have it for a month? Can't you go back and stay with those nuts, the Hombros?"
So even though she had agreed, she was trying to get me out. I felt the futility of trying to make any rational agreement with her.
"Tell Nat that I agree," I said, "if I can stay a month. I'll work it out with him. You're too unscientific." After a few more exchanges, she said goodbye, and we both hung up. Anyhow, I considered that I had agreed, even if it wasn't in writing. The house would be mine until the end of April. Or more accurately and realistically, until April 23rd.